WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us, sir. How are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Oh, welcome to another Monday Night Talk. It so happens to be the holiday edition, depending on what you want to call the holiday. Some folks call it Columbus Day. The new thing is now Indigenous Peoples Day. Whatever you want to call it, I hope you're enjoying your holiday. Thank you for tuning in to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. And as we try to do on a regular basis, on a weekly basis, keep you informed, have a variety of folks that we chat with about different subjects, different conversations. Tonight is no different. We'll start out after traffic. We'll check in with Braintree Mayor Joe Sullivan. I'm going to have the mayor on to talk a little bit about, they had a luncheon last week. Actually, it was a news story that you heard on WATD News late last week, where you had a couple of the South Shore mayors joining, meeting up with a former Kentucky Governor Stephen Beshear, all put together by former Congressman Billy, it'll come to me. Just give me a couple of moments here. But he's going to be talking a little bit about that conversation that they had about the opioid epidemic. It's kind of a big deal. And they sat and compared notes. They discussed it. And so we'll have a chance to speak with the mayor about that luncheon that he was a part of. As well, we're going to speak with a candidate running for state rep in the 7th Plymouth District. Folks may or may not know, the current state rep, Jeff Deal, he is running for U.S. Senate. And so people are looking at that seat, 2018. Peter Drosos is here. Peter is actually sitting here right in front of me. And we'll try to chat with Peter in just a moment or two and tease his segment coming up at 6:40. 7 o'clock, we will speak with Dr. John Huber. He is a clinical forensic psychologist, and chat with him about the Las Vegas massacre. We've spoke with John in the past when it's come to incidents like this, yet another one being deemed probably one of the deadliest in American history at this particular time. 59 dead, 515 injured during that incident that took place in Las Vegas during a music festival. We'll chat with him and kind of get his thoughts on where things stand with the individual who was the person who was the shooter, Stephen Paddock, 64 years old. They don't have a lot of information on him, and they're still trying to put together the details, but what is in the mind of somebody who does something like this? We'll speak with Dr. Huber about that, and then we'll speak with David Wheeler. We've had David on here in the past. David, a columnist for Gatehouse Media. He's kind of on a little bit of a hiatus right now. He's an author. He's out there trying to get the word out about his new novel called Broke Town. So we'll chat with David about that. Now, we got half a minute here to chat a little bit. We got Peter Drosos, who's here. Peter?
Very pleased to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Peter, just kind of cruising in. Peter, who I actually know his brother.
Uncle.
See, why did I think... See, Alex, you owe me. Alex Drosos, who I see at many political events, who's a supporter. And
well, I would sure hope so.
Well, no, but and as I was saying to you, and we'll get into the nuts and bolts of it at 6:40. But I was expecting somebody, if there was somebody who would throw their hand into the ring, it was him. I didn't expect that his nephew would be somebody who would be throwing his hat. But it's a pleasant surprise, and of course, he graces us with some tasty Venus pizza.
My family's owned the Venus Cafe in Whitman for 53 years, and my dad thought it would be a nice gesture to...
And your dad's name is?
John.
Thank you, John, very much.
To bring down some pizzas and, you know, get a shameless plug in there whilst introducing myself to the people of the 7th Plymouth.
And we'll, of course, talk with you more at 6:40. We thank you for showing up early.
Thank you.
I love this time of year. Rustling leaves, a crisp wind blowing, apple picking for homemade apple pie, a sunny day in a corn maze, a bonfire on a cool night. Cigars, and a half gallon of hot apple cider. Apple pie. We made it ourselves. This has nothing to do with Brennan's Smoke Shop, but everything to do with life. It's short, yet so sweet. Kind of like pumpkin spice coffee. It comes and goes like autumn wind. Brennan's Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now on Pope's Island in New Bedford. Brennan's Smoke Shop, the very best smoke shop in Massachusetts. Customers must have a valid state or federal ID to enter the store. Message me on Facebook.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk, and we are privileged to speak with my on-again, off-again, sometimes co-host, a good friend, Mayor Joe Sullivan of Braintree, who joins us. Mayor, welcome back to Monday Night Talk.
Thank you, Kevin. It's always great to be with you, but you're the ultimate host, not me.
Well, here's the thing. Don't feel, we still have a deal that one of these days you are going to come in here and right. Actually be the host. Now, whether I'm a wingman or I'm away that week, who knows? You will take over the helm.
Well, I thought the transaction was you were going to become mayor of Braintree as well for a day.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm still plotting that.
I think some folks would enjoy that actually.
At least for 24 hours, right?
It's a 24-hour-a-day job. I'll tell you that.
I bet it is. People don't realize that it isn't a 40-hour week that you work. That you're on the job.
Right.
You know, from the time your feet hit the bed, if they ever do.
Yeah, right, exactly. I'm enjoying it. So how are you?
We're doing pretty good. So the idea, we did a story late last week in regards to, you had a fellow that visited, a former governor of Kentucky, Steve Beshear, was in town.
Right.
This was something
right.
that was organized. It was a luncheon that was held at Quincy's old city hall.
Right.
And it was organized by former congressman. And I think he's the acting or interim director of the of one of Harvard's Institute for Politics, right?
Yeah, Institute for Politics is right. I actually was able to achieve my master's degree out of the Kennedy School many years ago, and Congressman Delahunt is now the, as you know, the interim director, and has brought in a tremendous array of talent really across the nation to help offer some instruction and education and really to have, I think, one of our important conversations through the IOP. And one of them, as you mentioned, was the former governor of Kentucky that we sat with last week. Tom Koch hosted us. It was myself, Bill Carpenter, the congressman, as well as Tommy Koch and the governor. And we talked all about the opioid issue that's affecting all of us and some of the steps we are all trying to take, not only individually as communities, but in conjunction with other efforts and really trying to build the right partnerships, not only locally, but through the federal and state governments and attack this issue in the aggressive way that we need to.
And it seemed as though, I mean, not that you and Mayor Carpenter or Mayor Koch don't talk on a regular basis and you guys aren't chatting from time to time whenever you're at various meetings that are held around the Commonwealth, but this was a chance to have a former congressman and a former, you know, governor of another state who actually had to deal with a similar crisis when it came to, you know, the opioids, and it was more or less the pills. And what was it like having to have those two individuals be a part of the conversation, too?
Well, I think it was important. I mean, I mean, we talk about it locally in terms of how this issue of opioid addiction, disease, has shattered families, you know, locally, and there's no boundaries geographically in terms of this epidemic. And to hear from the former governor of Kentucky that he faced, you know, similar issues in his state, as well as to hear from the congressman, you know, in terms of all the stories he told us that he heard in his years in the Congress, and also as a former district attorney. So, you know, the underlying point, I think, to all of us was that we're all facing this significant dilemma, and we're all working very hard at it. And candidly, you know, every day when you help someone, you know, you have to view it as a success. But every day you're out trying to prevent people from this type of addiction. And we just need to continue the effort. We've got in Braintree specifically, we have a community partnership on substance use, and we recognize it as a disease. And I think there's three important elements to the whole program. Number one, you bring all the folks together.
Mm.
Their parents who've lost loved ones, school officials, police, a fire, you know, the medical people, all really, you know, around the table, if you will, on a regular basis, figuring out a strategy that we hope is going to be as comprehensive as we can. And in that strategy, we raise the level of awareness so that folks truly understand that we are committed in this fight. But we also, I think, reduce the stigma associated with this addiction. A lot of people don't want to talk about it. We need to talk about it. And then the other component is education. You know, we have Narcan with our first responders and the police and fire and Brewster Ambulance do a tremendous job. We have Narcan available to our school, you know, with the responsibility of our nurses. We're one of the few communities to have that. And it's not for the school kids as much as it may be for a parent who is a user, unfortunately. And so, you know, we are, you know, fully focused on this. We have all availability in terms of treatments. We need to get beds in place. One of the things we talked about, Kevin, that I think is really important, and I think people are becoming more and more focused on, is to truly try to go after the drug dealers, to try to work with our district attorneys, try to work with others who can prosecute people who are selling, you know, heroin and fentanyl. And so we need to be aggressive in that posture as well. You know, we can do what we can, and I'll say kind of on the defensive side in terms of the usage of Narcan and saving lives and having that available to families and to those who need it. But really, to go on the offense, we need to go after the drug dealers, and to stay in terms of treatment, we need to provide beds so that people can get a full recovery. So it's a series of steps, and, you know, the chat we had the other day is just a continuation of the conversations we've been having for a long time, and, you know, putting together a comprehensive strategy that we're implementing now.
Well, it sounds to me like you're talking about that you need further legislation, and then it needs to be enacted by the judicial system to be able to make sure that if an individual is someone who is dealing heroin, fentanyl,
right,
carfentanyl, that this
right.
is something that the punishment is going to be one that it's almost like the little kid. It's like the little
yeah.
kid that you tell not to touch the stove, and they got to wait until they actually touch it, and get burned. It has to
right.
be to that effect.
Yeah, I don't think we need legislation. I mean, I think we've got the ability to do it now.
Enforcement.
I mean, this is murder. And I know it's a strong term, but it's true. This is, in my view, murder. It's manslaughter at a minimum, where, you know, drug dealers are just need to be held to, you know, accountable for their actions. And so, you know, I've had conversations with our district attorney, Mike Marcy. I know he's focused on this issue. I know it's a complicated issue, and I'm not trying to simplify it at all. But I am saying that we need to go to the root of the problem. And I think all of us are starting to discover that the root of the problem, obviously, is this illegal drug activity that's taking place, and we need to stop it. And one of the ways we need to stop it is to get aggressive on the prosecution side.
Okay, we're speaking with Braintree Mayor Joe Sullivan, who is our guest for this first segment of Monday Night Talking a little bit about a a luncheon, a discussion that was held with the three of us, Elshon Mayers, along with Billy Delahunt, who kind of helped organize this, along with a former governor of Kentucky from 2007 to 2015, Governor Stephen Beshear, who's actually, I believe, his son is now a district attorney, or he is an AG or something in Kentucky, right?
Yeah. His son is the attorney general in Kentucky, and the governor was previously the attorney general as well.
Right.
He's a very impressive man, had a great command of the language, very articulate, and was very focused and candidly understands the depth of this issue from his home state of Kentucky, and it's bringing that perspective to the IOP right now.
One of the things that I understood from doing a little research and having some conversations with other individuals who partook in this was that there was a little bit of a consensus in regards to what's going on down in D.C. Kind of give me your thoughts as to some of the conversation and the consensus that was reached in regards to what needs to be done by our president and the folks who represent us down in D.C.
Well, Congressman Delahunt, you know, still has many contacts in Washington and still speaks frequently with current members of the Congress. And, you know, just Bill is just a premier spokesman in so many ways. And on this particular issue, you know, he's made contact with some folks. There's a whole series of, you know, federal officials both in the Congress and on the regulatory side in terms of the FDA and other federal agencies. That he's had, as I said, conversations with, and I think, you know, he made the declaratory statement that, you know, we need to call this a national epidemic, and his sense was that, you know, President Trump needs to really focus on this, have a very active drug czar position in place, which former President Obama had in place as well, and I believe that position is filled. I don't know that specifically, but I believe it is, but it needs to just be on the forefront of a national agenda. And that's what Congressman Delahunt was underlining in the conversation that we had you know, the other day. And I think, you know, all of us recognize, number one, that we're not in this alone.
Mm.
And number two, you can't just handle it at the local level. I mean, it is something we're confronting and we're addressing as best and as vigorously as we can. But we do need federal partners in terms of some funding and some programs, as well as we need state partners. You know, Governor Baker deserves a lot of credit. He's been on the forefront of this issue, dealing with this matter in a very aggressive way. And I've been with him where he's, you know, told the story of talking to loved ones who've come up to him. And he would tell you that he got sensitized to this issue when he ran for governor in 2014. And he kept hearing it and kept hearing the stories of drug overdoses and you know, families so shattered by what was going on, and that became you know, a primary focus for him. And to his credit, he's kept that in place. We secured in Braintree, we secured two Department of Public Health grants, and Representative Cusack and Senator Keenan, Senator Timothy have helped in that effort in terms of securing some funding. We put together funding at the local level, so we have money in place. We have we're currently looking for a new director of our substance use program. Our former director just recently left us. She'd be located in Florida. So we're in the process of looking to hire someone to lead this effort on a daily basis underneath our health department. So, you know, we're at the local level. We've got funding in place. We've got, you know, programs that we're working on at the federal level. We need that continued support and that focus. And at the state level, we're enjoined to, again, access programs that are available to us. So there is, you know, a series of steps that we've taken. But, you know, the fight continues. Each and every day, the fight continues. And it just has to be and has to remain, I should say, a focus for all of us.
Yeah, when you were talking about the governor and how he was, you know, while he was on the campaign trail speaking with people about this epidemic and what's going on. Well, as somebody who is a mayor and somebody who interacts with people all the time, you hear and see this on a daily basis, do you not?
Yeah, I do. You know, I've like everybody, I have family, I have a cousin who lost a son, and So, yes, I do hear the stories. I think they're so personal in nature that I wouldn't want to comment on them publicly. But I would tell you that, obviously, there are some really incredible stories of loss. And it does. It impacts you. It's something that, obviously, these parents will never forget. I will say I think of Peter and Heather Thompson in Branch, who lost their son, Ryan. They're very, outspoken on that in terms of, in a good way. They've been incredibly financially supportive of programs both there in Braintree and in Quincy. And Peter's just, his heart is broken, as is Heather's, over the loss of their son, Ryan, which actually happened, I believe it was 7 years ago now, back in 2010. They face that every single day. Robin Houston Bean, who's on our community partnership for substance use, is a parent who lost her son, Nick. Again, these are people who live in Braintree, who are active with our community partnership, and have tried to turn a terrible tragedy into some type of positive with their work and their support of what we're doing here in Braintree. And both of them I admire greatly. Both families I admire greatly, and I'm grateful to them on behalf of the town for their work, because we need their efforts. We need their stories to be told, and they're willing to tell those stories. But it is very very difficult for them, and we have them in our thoughts all the time.
Probably one of the last questions that I'll ask you, Mayor, is we know that since the start of the year that the conversation down in Washington, D.C. is the repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act. And yeah. One of the things that, I've learned through conversations is that while there may be problems with the Affordable Care Act in certain instances, it has been important in dealing with the opioid crisis and seeking treatment. So I would think that there's a lot of concern that whatever is done in regards to affordable care, that it's something that it's that one component that treats those who need treatment. That's still relevant in whatever's put together down on the federal level?
Yeah, I mean, healthcare is an evolving issue, and it will always continue to be. I'm not an expert on it in terms of what's happening at the federal level by any means, but I can tell you just a couple of quick thoughts. Number one, I do think the Affordable Care Act, which allows kids to be on, the parents program, if you will, till age 26, is important. That gives health insurance to those who are young and still, in many ways, maybe just in college or graduate school or searching for work. And so as long as they have health care up until age 26, at least there's some additional coverage in place. Additionally, as you know, Kevin, there's programs available to the Affordable Care Act now, financial support and recognition of the opioid issue and the epidemic associated with it. So there's funding that is now currently in place that wasn't in place previously. I will contrast that with a conversation I had recently with a woman who was self-employed. Her and her husband have their own business. And, she was telling me how, they were spending approximately $700 a month, I believe it was, just, 5 years ago on health insurance. Again, private business. And today, just to cover the family, they're spending $3,000 a month. And she was just saying that it's a financial burden that obviously is something that they need and they're going to have in place, but it is incredibly expensive. And so there's that balance. There's the cost of having good quality health care, and how do you pay for it, and how do you not cripple small businesses in the economy, and making sure that you do have quality health care in place. And the other piece to it, just beyond the finances, is that healthcare is a very emotional issue. You don't really think about your healthcare until you need it. And there are so many families, beyond the opioid issue, but also with terrible illnesses and cancer and other diseases, that you need to have the level of quality and the level of care through your healthcare provider. But it is expensive. And so how you, cost out the financials on that, but also make sure that you have appropriate and high levels of coverage in place so that every American can, number one, have access to health care, but also in an affordable way, is an ongoing conversation, an ongoing discussion that we're having really at all levels of government. Here in Braintree, we're self-insured. We're not affiliated with GIC, the Group Insurance Commission, at the state level. We've worked very closely with our unions. We've had, some tough negotiations because there's a cost, and obviously the municipality has to pay some of that cost, but individuals have to pay it as well. So we've come to an equation currently that allows us to continue to provide quality health care for our employees and their families. But there is a financial cost to all of this, and that's not always difficult to solve.
Mayor, I want to thank you for taking a few moments out of your busy day to join us and talk a little bit about that unique luncheon that you were able to be a part of, that discussion.
Yeah, it was very good.
Anything you want to say in closing, sir?
No, Kevin, just always enjoy being with you. I appreciate you putting the spotlight on this issue. I didn't realize it would get, I viewed it as somewhat of a private conversation, but I guess everything you do in public life somehow becomes public in terms of the work we're doing, and it was a good meeting. Bill Carpenter with his champion program in Brockton, and obviously Mayor Koch has really been on the forefront of this issue as well. Both of them deserve recognition and credit for the efforts they're making, and the congressman was just terrific once again, and his ability to bring people together and have these important conversations is something that we should always appreciate and treasure.
There he is, Braintree Mayor Joe Sullivan, our guest for this segment, and we'll look forward to, of course, having him on in the near future as he's a regular. We're going to step aside, and when we come back, more Monday Night Talk. I promise. Don't go anywhere.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
I love this time of year. Rustling leaves, a crisp wind blowing, apple picking for homemade apple pie, a sunny day in a corn maze, a bonfire on a cool night. Cigars, and a half gallon of hot apple cider. Apple pie. We made it ourselves. This has nothing to do with Brennan's Smoke Shop, but everything to do with life. It's short, yet so sweet. Kind of like pumpkin spice coffee. It comes and goes like autumn wind. Brennan's Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now on Pope's Island in New Bedford. Brennan's Smoke Shop, the very best smoke shop in Massachusetts. Customers must have a valid state or federal ID to enter the store. Message me on Facebook.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
All right, we are back here for the second segment of Monday Night Talk. Oddly enough, and I didn't mention it during our interview with the mayor, and that is that it was Billy Delahunt, who I couldn't spit out the first couple of moments of the radio show, who he heads up. He's the interim acting director of the Harvard's Institute on Politics. So he was kind of the one who kind of put that whole luncheon together. So just a little disclaimer there as we move forward to our next segment. And a gentleman who came in, and has been here, and his political posse is here. Oddly enough, I know his uncle, Alex, and I very much know the Venus's Cafe.
Thank you very much.
But this is my first introduction to Peter Drosos, who is actually running for the 7th Plymouth District state rep seat. Of course, the 7th Plymouth District is Abington, East Bridgewater.
Three precincts of East Bridgewater. Not all of East Bridgewater.
I know. I know. We don't really get super duper technical here, Peter.
Yeah, fair enough.
Just so you know, but you as a candidate,
should know that.
It's very good that you know that.
So I get the first checkmark, right?
So who is the state rep that actually has that other precinct?
I would think it's Michelle Dubois, right?
That is correct. Yeah. State Rep Michelle Dubois of the 10th Plymouth District.
Yeah, 10th Plymouth, yeah.
10th Plymouth. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm very happy to be here, and thank you for allowing me the time. It's very important to me, obviously, to do everything that I can to reach out to the community and make sure that I'm available and transparent, and I want to be as available to the people that I'm asking for a job as possible. The reasons for me deciding to do this are, you know, they're multifaceted, as any decision like this would be. I felt the timing was particularly perfect, considering that the seat is open. There's a dearth of Republican, you know, prospective Republican candidates. And I feel like this is a great time for us to introduce our ideas about what's important, about what we want to do in government, make sure that our district, which has traditionally been fairly conservative, considering where we are, to continue presenting those ideas, presenting that argument, and I'd like to be the champion of that. So,
well, the first thing you're going to have to do before you are somebody who's on the ballot after next September's primary is earn your party's nomination. You're out early. Here we are. You know, a lot of folks would probably typically get out there and mobilize maybe after New Year's. Okay, just a political guess on my behalf, but I have watched the formation of many campaigns. I've seen campaigns that get off and they get started early, and they're able to be able to, I mean, the idea is to get your name out there.
Absolutely.
And get it into the heads of those. Talk to us about any experience that you may have, whether it's as somebody who's been appointed to a board or somebody who has done civic work within the community.
The crux of my resume would probably be the work that I've done with charitable ventures through the restaurant that my family owns. Also, I sit on the Republican Town Committee in Whitman. So I try to stay as engaged and as active, you know, albeit from a fairly partisan point of view, but as engaged and active in the happenings of the community as possible. And all the more reason to try to reach out and do more work by running for an elected seat.
What's your understanding of the district? What's your understanding of the district issues? Because I would believe each community would have onto itself its own issues.
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting you bring that up. It's actually a nice segue to some of the things I'd like to talk about. Every time I meet a new voter, every time I meet somebody who I'm generally unfamiliar with, their first thing that they're going to bring up is the thing that's most important to them. And I've started to pick up on some trends. The people from Whitman are more fiscally inclined. They're going to talk about taxes first. They're much more interested in keeping money in their wallets. How am I going to make sure that they're not overtaxed? In East Bridgewater, it seems to be the schools. The schools seem to be the most important thing to the residents of East Bridgewater. In Abington, the people I've met, they're talking about the drug problem. And covering all of those things and being up to date and knowledgeable and involved on all of those things is something that we're endeavoring to do as best as we can to make sure that the people will feel comfortable electing me to a position to speak on those things on their behalf.
What was the decision to run for this? What wisdom was imparted onto you when you decided, I'm going to be the guy who's going to run for this? What some of the conversations you had with some of the folks in the Whitman Town Committee, and you're like, I'm thinking of doing this. And I know some of the members that are within that committee. What was some of the stuff that you guys talked about? And they said, listen, this is what you got to do if you're going to be successful.
Well, everybody, whether it be people that I've worked with more intimately or people that I just know passingly, everybody has said that the most important thing is getting out and meeting people. Policy can be discussed and can be debated, but at the end of the day, people, especially in a smaller or more localized election, want to feel a connection to the candidate. They want to feel a connection to the person that's representing them. And that's the beautiful part about our system of government. That's why I'm so excited and intrigued by this wonderful opportunity. We live in a place that has a system that is designed that one of us, we as a community get together and select one person to be our voice. That's a huge responsibility. But it's also something that if you have the acumen, if you have the desire, if you have the hope, it's you have to have a hopeful attitude towards this, because if you don't love the way that our government works, if you don't love the idea of representation, then you're in the wrong game. And I feel very passionately about our system of government, and I'd like to be a part of it. It's easy to sit on the internet and yell and scream and complain. It's something else entirely to put your name out there and try to make a difference.
It's interesting that you bring up the internet, you bring up social media, and you look at today's you look at the current environment, political environment, and you're seeing, I'm seeing something that I've never seen before, where people are so upset, so disdain, whether it's their candidate was successful or their candidate was successful, and the rhetoric that goes back and forth. And it's, you know, it seems as though we have drifted far one way or the other. Some would call it an alt type of a reality. And there's not a lot of commonality when it comes to having conversations. How tricky is it going to be for you as a candidate, somebody who is a Republican, to try to be able to navigate the waters and be able to get your word out there as a state rep candidate?
Well, you mentioned the word rhetoric. I think rhetoric has replaced dialogue. Rhetoric has replaced discussion. The idea, and I don't mean to preach, I don't mean to lecture, I'm not a history professor, so it's very easy for me to stand here with my opinion, but I'm going to state it anyway. The idea of our system of government is to entice conversation, is to entice debate. But now it seems more important not to resolve the issue, but to win the issue. Mm. It seems, especially nationally, not so much in Massachusetts.
Win the issue at all costs.
At all costs. Mm. No matter what you have to sell to get there.
Right.
And this is more of a national thought than more specific to what we're trying to accomplish here. But it seems as though we're going to elect one ideology, and then we're going to elect the other ideology just to reverse all the work that the previous ideology had done, as opposed to finding and promoting and propping up candidates that are willing to listen to opposing points of view and come to some commonality, borrow another one of your words.
Yes.
Seeking commonality is the function of government, one of the two most important functions of government. One is preserving the liberty of the people. And two is seeking and finding commonality. Absolutely. And I'd like to be a part of that as opposed to part of the mudslinging and the rhetoric.
Talk to me about getting involved in a race like this, because it isn't like you have an incumbent that is the main target. It's technically,
and it's the Wild West.
It's a free for all. You're going to have a slew of folks who are independents. You're going to have Republicans. You're going to have Dems. Of course, they're all trying to vie for, you know, at least for the two-party system, you're going to have Democrats that are going to be vying for that nomination. You're going to be one of who knows how many Republicans vying for, because it's an open seat.
Yeah, absolutely.
Give me your thoughts on being a part of that process and being able to make sure that you can get your message out, whether it's out during an event, or if you are squaring off against another individual and it comes to talking about the issues.
Well, for me, you know, I did say earlier that personal relationships with as many of the constituents as possible is something that I can't wait to get started on. You know, we're starting to map out routes to do some door knocking. I'll be coming, you know, through all the towns in the district trying to meet as many people as possible so they know that I am available to them. I am present and accounted for. Accountable leadership at this level, at any level, but especially, you know, all politics are local, especially at the local level. If people feel connected to the people that are representing them, they'll feel as though they're actively engaged in the process. I feel like our biggest problem, both locally and nationally, is a disconnect from government. Government has become so big that it's become all-encompassing. I feel as though if we take an attitude of pulling government's scope of influence back just a little bit and allowing the people to feel a little bit more involved, then we might do well to solve some more of our problems that way.
Yeah, we're speaking with Peter Drosos. He is a candidate for state representative in the 7th Plymouth District. Talk to me about organizing. I know some of the people that you have involved with your campaign organization and folks who know what they're doing when it comes to getting out there, whether it's knocking on doors, whether it's doing standouts, whether it's putting literature out there. How important is it to be able to have a good organization behind you?
Well, I mean, I think Vince Lombardi said every game is won and lost in the preparation. So I made it a point before I decided to officially announce that I had a team of people that, A, believed in me, because that's important, and B, believed in the message that we're trying to get out there. So I've sort of pillaged from previous candidates and previous elections throughout the district and got whatever talent that I could to help me out. And I'm very, very happy to not only have my uncle, but my campaign manager, Greg, who's worked hand-in-hand with the Deal campaign in various capacities over the years. And his father, Jerry Eaton. We also have some other people, Miles Heeker from East Bridgewater and Rob Hubner from Bridgewater, who are helping out. And I'm happy to have the team together. We're all pretty young. We're all pretty excited. We're all willing and able and trying to do the best that we can to put our message out there.
But you're ready for the marathon, because that's...
Oh, it's not a sprint by any means. No,
right.
It's a plotted course. It takes precision. It takes care. It takes dedication from all of us. And the fact of the matter is that you have to believe in what you're doing to do that effectively.
Just got a couple of more moments left with you. One of the last things I should ask you is your age. You're a young guy.
Yeah, I'm 30 years old.
You're 30 years old. But here's the thing. And folks don't realize this. And they go, oh, he's young. But youth doesn't mean anything. I look at the city of Brockton, and you know, I had a young man named Jack Lally,
yeah,
who was successful. I want to say this is before his 21st birthday. He might have been younger than that.
I think he was 18.
Yeah. You look at State Senator Patrick O'Connor, another guy, successful, a young guy, a relatively young guy. What do you take from individuals like that and be able to, and if someone goes, oh, you're kind of young?
Well, I mean, you can cite them as examples of success for people who are in my age bracket or around my age bracket. The idea is not necessarily the vessel, it's the message. And if I am a perfect vessel to deliver that message, that's great. At the same time, though, like I said earlier, it's all about personality and it's all about your willingness to put yourself out there. And I feel like being young gives you an advantage in that, because people like seeing youth. People like seeing somebody who, you know, it's very easy for older generations to look at me and say, ah, he's young, he doesn't care, he doesn't know what he's doing. It's got to be refreshing, I think, especially the entire team, all of us being, you know, 30 or younger, except for Alex.
Alex, I think he just threw you under the bus.
With all of us being, for politics, young, I think that's got to be encouraging. Whether you agree with us, disagree with us, aren't sure about us, it's got
to
be
next generation. We're expecting for leaders to bloom from within your generation.
Yeah, I mean, the millennials as a group have been criticized for myriad things. But one thing I think we can all say, whether we're conservative, liberal, somewhere in between, is that we're all very socially active, socially conscious, and we're all very aware of what our responsibilities are in a social context. And that extends to me as well. I'm part of that thought process. I grew up going to school, learning about all of this, and saying, I want to do this. I want to have a role in this.
If folks want to find out more about you, more about your campaign, events that you got coming up, and if you want to mention, you got one I know coming up just around the corner, give that information to our listeners right now.
Absolutely. On the 23rd of October, appropriately enough, at the Venus Cafe in Whitman, we will be holding our kickoff, our campaign kickoff rally.
South Ave.
47 South Ave, Whitman.
Across from Town Hall.
Yep, thank you. Mm-hmm. 7 p.m. On that day, we'll have finalized where you can find us online, our social media platform, and I'm sure you'll see Facebook ads and the like. So there it is.
And maybe you'll show up on somebody's doorstep.
Oh, absolutely.
You'll
definitely be seeing me in that capacity for sure.
Peter, I want to thank you for joining us. I want to thank your dad, John, and the family for supplying us with some great Venus Cafe pizza.
Absolutely. Thank
definitely
you
definitely love
us.
It. 47 South Avenue, Whitman. Don't forget, but you guys only care about just the one, because I know, aren't there three Venuses?
Yeah, my cousins own the other ones, and you know, they do a good business, and I hope they do well, but you know, we all
the original Venus Cafe located
in Whitman.
In Whitman, where October 23rd. There
kickoff,
will be a kickoff for Peter Drosos, who has been our guest. Now, I'm going to extend the invitation for you to stay and your team to stay if you want to participate in our conversation with Dr. John Huber. You can also choose to say thank you very much and exit the building in a kind fashion and go from there. If you want, I can announce what you planned on doing, or you could just surprise the folks when we come back.
Why don't we leave it as a tease for the audience?
We'll leave it for a tease. And what we're going to do is we're going to step aside when we come back the second hour of Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD. Don't go anywhere.
The South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
I'm Peter from Tiny and Sons Glass. You know, my grandpa's family car never got a broken windshield. My dad's never got a broken windshield either. Why? I did some research. The Department of Transportation reports back in 1940, Americans drove 333 million miles at 35 miles an hour. Now we drive 3 trillion miles at 75 miles an hour. So there it is. We drive more, we drive faster. So we hit highway debris more often and at greater speeds. Safety glass does not shatter, but it will crack and it will pit. We at Tiny and Sons Glass, we come to you. We come to your home, we come to your work. We even come to your kid's soccer practice. We replace your windshield. Insurance pays. 1-888-64-TINY. Just call.
Your Department of Transportation advises the national speed limit is 65 miles per hour, not 75.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, we're back for hour number two of Monday Night Talk. Later on in this segment, we will speak with Mr. David Wheeler, author of the novel Broke Town. He is going to be joining us at around 7:30. But right now, we are speaking with a gentleman who has actually been on the segment. And I think we're going to have... are you just listening, Alex? Or
I'm listening.
You're going to add some... Okay. So we have on the line, a gentleman who's been with us before. He's joined us for a couple of times this year.
Yes.
Dr. John Huber is our guest. He is a clinical psychologist. And we can talk a little bit about the shooting in Las Vegas, kind of get his take on this situation. What he's been, because this is a gentleman who spends, how many different TV and radio stations do you help or give information to?
Well, I did Monday after the shooting hit the airwaves. I did 14 different radio interviews and 2 television, and then 2 more television, and another 8 the next day.
So you're pretty popular guy, and we are appreciative, and we want to also congratulate your Houston Astros. You are a Texas guy, so I want to at least congratulate.
Of course, thank you.
Because I think I had you on right around after the Super Bowl, and I kind of teased you a little bit about the. The Texans not doing too well in the Patriots, so it's kind of a, you know, there's like a yin and a yang to it. So, it is what it is.
It is what it is, and that's a good thing about being in Texas. You know, you just give it a few days, and somebody will do something good here, and then a few days later, somebody will dig a hole. We want to stick our heads in high.
Just so you know, I'll have a couple of other individuals who are going to join in. We have Peter and Alex Drosos, who are sitting in on this segment, and Dr. John Huber. You can find out more from his website, www.mainstreammentalhealth.org. John's also the chair of the Mainstream Mental Health. It's a nonprofit organization. And I want to get your take on initially seeing this incident taking place. I remember waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and initially they were saying 2 individuals were dead, and there were a handful that were injured. And as we all know, those numbers steadily climbed and changed throughout the morning into later on in the day. Give me your thoughts on initially hearing the information as it was being reported.
Well, initially, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is a terroristic act, you know. And what did they do? They got us at our most vulnerable. And you had people out there celebrating, having a good time, enjoying the freedoms that we have here in America, and bam. I mean, we had no idea what was going on, and it was scaring lots of people. And here in Austin, we have Austin City Limits Festival this weekend, or this past weekend and this coming weekend, and, you know, they were sold out months ago, and people were selling their tickets back to the festival's organizers.
It's a scary thing. And there's been reports that the reported gunman, Stephen Paddock, actually was scouting other cities and looking at other venues, Chicago,
yes,
Boston, for possibly doing something similar like this. We haven't really heard a lot about Stephen Paddock other than family members and the girlfriend that are denying that that there's any kind of warning signs that this was going to happen.
Well, and that's the interesting thing. Most people who commit terroristic acts technically are not mentally ill. They don't have schizophrenia or depression or any type of mania that's going to make them stand out and lose their ability to remain quiet and clandestine about their actions. So if he were to show up in my office for me to evaluate him, he would probably, in the most point, look like a very clean profile, like you know, 70% of Americans would. So he's well hidden in that, as far as that's concerned. He's not talking in bizarre language, and he's not talking about things that sound like fantasy or a loss of reality. The unfortunate thing about that is that's the reality we have to deal with when we talk about somebody who makes a decision to do something like this. Unless they share that information with people, it's going to be very difficult to identify, you know, up front before they actually start the process.
What is your psychological analysis of this individual and his actions? I mean, if you look at what he did, he picked out a room. He basically cased the joint. He was very careful as far as bringing in his armada, setting up cameras so that he would be alerted if there was anybody coming towards his door. It was very methodical. There's even been forensics that he actually was shooting at the airport at some of the tanks that had fuel. Your thoughts?
And that's what I heard. Definitely, this man was a very logical person. I mean, he knew what he was doing. He had his pilot's license and modern aircraft at one point. So we know he understands technology and he can utilize that to his advantage. And he planned this whole thing just like he was planning a flight route, you know, and he's going to take off from this airport and he's going to go to this altitude and travel for so many minutes and go to the next altitude and so on and so forth. It was very thought out and methodical. And it's somebody that has skills to do that. And they were taught to him through training. And then he was also, unbeknownst to his family that lived in Florida, he was a hunter and he'd actually been to Alaska and gone big game hunting. So this guy had actual experience handling firearms in somewhat threatening situations. So, you know, he's a smart man. Now, is he rational? Well, most of, like I said, he would show up as a rational person until we ask him about this area, which we don't really know what it is. Most terrorists go after ideologies behind religion or politics. There are a few outliers, and those outliers usually feel like society has harmed them somehow, and they're going to pay society back. So until we get the information from the FBI and the data that they've collected, I'm pretty sure at this point they have a good idea, and they're not going to tell us until they know 100%, but they have a good idea if he falls into one of those three categories.
Alex Drosos, do you have a question for Dr. John Huber?
Hey, Dr. Huber, how are you?
Great, Alex, how are you?
Great. As far as the paper they found in the hotel room, it had a lot of mathematical equations on it for best areas to shoot in the festival. Can you function at that level if you have a mania or a mental illness?
It would be very difficult. Mania is one of the one things, though, where people tend to hold it together. Mm. Just look at Elon Musk with Tesla. I mean, he talked about how he would go through manic periods and go for days working on one project, and he created Tesla. So I'm not going to say it's impossible. There are some people with the intelligence that can do that. But again, I'm not seeing the evidence that he has a documented history of mental health issues.
And that's the thing, is we've seen in the past at Sandy Hook, the elementary school, you had mental illness there. You've seen various degrees of it depending on the instant. Columbine, I think that there was an instance.
They
that
said they were going to do it.
They were going to do it, and there was some.
And they told everybody. Told everybody too.
They told everybody, but we have so many. This is again that mathematical equation. We don't know what X is at this particular time, and I don't know if we ever will, because it appears, at least according to the investigation, and it's nothing that the Las Vegas police or the FBI or anybody else, any other law enforcement agency, is releasing in regards to it. It's like one of those things we're not going to find out until, you know, the big documentary comes out about this individual.
Probably, unfortunately for us. And the left, that leads us to speculate. And one of the things that's interesting, most people with mental health issues in this country are the victims of abuse or violence. Very few of them are instigators. When we see them react, they tend to be someone who feels like they're pinned into a corner and that's the only alternative they have. And they're very sloppy about it. You said Sandy Hook. Well, he killed everybody that he came in contact with until he got to the school and then started killing people there. So there was nothing elegant about the way he proceeded.
And as I was saying regarding mental health, I mean, this is an individual that didn't give off any. He was somebody who had a license to go and purchase guns. He did it legally, and you know, all the weapons that he had purchased. What do we do? I mean, because that's been part of the argument as to, you know, having stricter gun laws and stricter, you know, having something in place when it comes to mental health.
Well, and in this case, too, I mean, I would like to see a gun law that would have stopped this. I don't think there is one. If he was denied purchasing the guns, he had enough money, he could have gone and got them off the black market. I don't see how another law, I mean, it's already illegal to kill somebody. So, I don't see what another law would do but restrict people who aren't going to do these types of things from accessing guns.
And the other thing that I also found interesting, again, this is somebody who was highly successful.
Yes.
Somebody who was a retired accountant. He had money. It seemed as though he had all the finer things in life, multiple homes, you know, had a girlfriend. I think he even actually sent the girlfriend off. She suspects that he sent her off on vacation out of the country because she was going to break, you know, he was going to break up with her, you know? I just don't get it. Is there something I'm overlooking here? How can somebody who has the perceived perfect life, again, has this, you know, pilot's license, how does it happen?
How? That's a good question. Money tends to be a multiplier. If your life is going well and you get money, it goes better. If your life is not going well and you get money, it gets worse. Ask anybody who's won the lottery. We've done tons and tons of research with that. People who are depressed and having all these problems and everything else, when they win the lottery, they have a period of 9 to 12 months where the world kind of seems perfect, and then all their problems become magnified, and they're the same ones they had before they didn't have money. Only now it's magnified thousands of times.
Now, he was a gambler, somebody who loved to gamble. How does that play into this? Is there anything into his habits that could tell more about him?
Well, yeah, we know right away he's a risk taker, and that money doesn't necessarily mean a lot to him. If money was of value to him, he might risk it by throwing it at charity and watching, you know, kids get free college or homeless people have homes. Instead, he goes for the rush. He gets that adrenaline rush. Yeah, I could lose $10,000 here, but what if I win? And he lives for that rush. So that makes him, I think, another one of these persons who, I want to see what the ultimate rush is, but he wanted to be in control of it. And in a lot of ways, he was very cowardish, hiding so far away inside the room so they couldn't even see the muzzle flash. I haven't seen a single video that showed a muzzle flash coming out of there. He was smart about it. And then he set up all those cameras so he knew what was going and who was outside the door, when they were outside the door, so when he could end it when he was ready, not when the police were ready.
Being somebody, again, you've been on multiple news outlets and media outlets. Have you heard any conspiracy theories in regards to that this wasn't a lone shooter type of a thing? Have you heard anything like that, that he could have been in tandem with somebody else or others?
Well, you know, what I have seen, someone has shown me receipts from the first couple of days he was at the Mandalay Bay, nothing after the 28th, but showed, like, all of his meal receipts were two entrees. So he was eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner with somebody else. But that doesn't mean he didn't, hey, you've been playing slots with me all day, let's go, I'll buy you dinner. Mm. You know, we don't know if that's what it was about or not. Until we see the videos and we can actually watch him walking around Mandalay, we're not going to know, and they're not giving those to us. The FBI has those. So, again, that's the government's got their hands on top of that. So I have heard a couple of these conspiracy theories, but they're from people who, for example, have never fired a gun before. So they don't understand
ballistics.
The ballistics. They don't understand the targeting. They've never fired a semi-automatic, let alone a semi-automatic with a bump stock on it and things like that. And that always kind of confuses me. They love to conceptualize this whole conspiracy because I think it makes them somehow powerful. You know, we can talk about some of these on the air black helicopter people that we've got one here in Austin, but there's just something that doesn't hold water in each one of the stories I've heard so far.
Alex, do you have another question for Dr. John Huber?
Doctor, that was great. I have a lot of respect for you for saying that because I think it does the victims a disservice, all this conspiracy stuff that I see on TV, on social media, and everything. I think it really does the victims and the victims' families a total disservice. So
I agree 100%.
Yeah, let the facts come out, and once they do, I think... you know, then we can discuss it. But to say this or happened or that happened, I think it really does the victims a disservice.
I agree 100%. And, you know, we're so used to our policing agencies, the CIA, NSA, FBI, releasing all little bits of information. And it's more like they're doing it to stir things up. This time they've held it close to their chest. And I kind of respect that. That's really what they should do. You know, worked with police investigations before, and you don't want to give out all your information until you know what you actually believe happened, and then you come forward with that.
Yeah, we're speaking with Dr. John Huber. This is a gentleman who has over 20 years of experience. He's a clinical forensic psychologist, and also, and I didn't mention this as part of his bio, he's a professor and teaches undergraduate and graduate psychology at Texas State University. What kind of conversation is this drumming up with your students? Is this something that has become part of the syllabus over this past term?
Well, you know, it's the whole fear thing. You know, in Texas, we're allowed to, we call it campus carry. Mm. If you qualify to hold a concealed firearm license, you can carry on campus. There are certain areas where you can't, where we have, for example, a developmental program where we have like a early childhood school and there's no guns allowed. It's a school, that type of thing. The reality of it is less than 3% of our student body even meet the minimum requirements to get a concealed handgun. And of those, probably less than 10% of that 3% would actually do it. But the person who's going to go on there, and the students have told me this time and time again, the person who's going to go on and do it, they don't care what the laws are. They're going to bring a gun on. They don't care if there's a law to do it or not. So I know that the question has brought up a lot of concern for some people who, again, have never been around a firearm, have never gone hunting, have never gone to the firing range, shot clay pigeons. And it's interesting how the students who've done those sort of things, they have a healthy respect for firearms, where I see students who've never been around them who have a fear, and it's irrational because they don't understand what they profess to know.
Mm. Alex, another question?
Yeah, I had one more question. As regarding medical issues, could he have had a...
Yeah, we're speculating, but yes, go
speculating.
Ahead.
I know I said I didn't like that earlier, but is it possible that he could have had a brain tumor similar to the University of Texas shooter did back in the 60s?
64. 64. You know, we don't know that at this point. What what I have heard, and I haven't had that confirmed, is that his license to fly was pulled because of a medical reason. Ooh. I don't know what that medical reason is, and that may have been speculation. Again, I haven't heard, I haven't got that confirmed, but usually, you know, if you're going along and you're flying your planes and you're getting your medical and you're staying in shape, usually it's something that's not very positive if you get your license pulled at that point.
Any thought? I know that his brother said that this is an individual who he didn't subscribe to politics, and he's the guy who made the cookies for mom and stuff like that. Any thought? You look at today's environment since the election of a new president. Now we have the Trump administration. Is there a possibility that politics played a role in this?
Oh, there's always a possibility. Politics, religion, you know, those are the things that you never talk about at the dinner table. Right. So I'm not surprised that the family didn't talk about that. He may have had totally different views than everybody else. There is the interesting thing is his dad was on the top 10 most wanted list by the FBI for being basically a psychopath and a bank robber and harming people. And there's one thought amongst some of my peers that we throw these things up and talk about that there may have been a genetic predisposition. Yep. And this may have just been building up all along and he was just waiting for his moment.
Wow. Because that was my next, if there was something genetically tied to, you know, he carried that gene and it was somehow it would one day manifest itself into what we, you know, saw took place recently.
And, you know, with genetics, it's just about everything's possible.
Anything that we haven't asked you in regards to this massacre that took place in Las Vegas that you feel is kind of important to at least apprising our listeners to as far as psychologically with this individual?
Well, psychologically, again, I haven't seen anything that showed that he had anything like bipolar or depression or schizophrenia. He probably did have a personality disorder. But a lot of people have personality disorders. I mean, you know, we have a lot of our entertainers are narcissists, and that's what makes them such good entertainers. They can jump from one character to the next, and we don't think that that's all that deviant. In fact, we give them millions of dollars. So personality disorders just kind of give people that attitude, and we're like, where did that come from? I didn't do anything to make them mad at me, but that's just who they are. And if he had that, like an antisocial personality disorder, which somebody goes, oh, but he had a girlfriend and he had good relationships with his family. Well, he really didn't have that good a relationship with his family. He talked with them, but nobody even knew he had a gun, and he had over 40 of them. So there wasn't that close-knit relationship. He was, you know, half a country away from his family. And so I'm not blaming the family for anything. I just don't think they knew everything that was going on with this man.
Almost like he lived, it was a secret life that he lived, like he was a secret agent or something. And, you know, his family, again, his brother looked somewhat dumbfounded, but it could have been an act, too.
It could be. But again, he lived in Florida there in Arizona, Nevada, sorry. The difference in distance and mileage in there, they said they talked all the time and his kids liked him. Well, why did the kids like him? He had money. He gave them good gifts. We don't know why the kids liked him. But that doesn't mean that he wasn't a psychopath or at least antisocial personality, because they tend to entertain the value of people that are close to them because they get a benefit from having those people around. It's the people who they don't get benefits from that feel the brunt of their pain.
It's interesting you say that, because the 55 or older community that he lived in, everybody had nice things to say about him, but I believe one of the reports that they had early on was that he paid six figures to kind of privatize his little piece of paradise so nobody would really know what's going on.
Exactly, to isolate his little assisted living area or whatever that was going to become at some point, definitely. Yeah. And that's pretty scary, you know, when you're talking about communal living and you got one person who signs up knowing what the place is and then immediately, you know, starts construction to isolate himself. That's a red flag.
Dr. Huber, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Anything you want to say in closing?
Just come check out our website at mainstreammentalhealth.org, and we've got a couple radio interviews with some experts on our radio blog at Mainstream Mental Health Radio that talk about these exact same things. We've got one author who wrote an amazing book on how to handle this if you're a victim in this kind of a shooting situation specifically.
Well, we thank you, and we look forward to the next time we have you on Monday Night Talk, sir.
Well, I appreciate it. You got a great show, and I'll be back anytime.
You got it. There he is. Talk to John Huber, our guest. What did you think, Alex?
He was outstanding. I just like it how he just went with the facts and didn't fly off on some
like dragnet, right?
Yeah.
Just the facts, man.
Just the facts, you know. Didn't Black Hawk helicopter lower the guy down and shoot. I like the way he stayed on point.
Did it change? Now, we don't know your point of view in regards to this whole tragedy that took place in Vegas. I mean, what was your thought when you heard the news in regards to this event? I mean, that, you know, we did have, you know, it was thought initially, it was ISIS did take some credit for some strange reason, but...
Yeah, initially I thought it was ISIS because that we just trained for that now. But then as, you know, the next couple of days came along, it came out, you know, who he was. I didn't like the overseas stuff, the wiring of money. That was kind of sketchy. But then he saw that he was giving her money to buy a house, his girlfriend. Just so many unanswered questions. And to speculate, like I said, I think it does it a disservice. But the planning was,
here's the thing. We didn't ask him, but I ask you, as the gentleman sitting across the table from me for the next 2 minutes. You know, we haven't heard anything relevant from the girlfriend other than she didn't know anything, just like the brother. He was a happy guy. He didn't get into politics. We've heard all of that, but yet there's no concrete reason. Like, again, there wasn't something that triggered him to go, that's it. You know, somebody bumped into him at the supermarket and didn't say, excuse me. It sent him off. Was that Falling Down with Kirk Douglas? What was the movie where he just...
Yeah, he got fired or laid off or something and just went ballistic. The one thing was the people at Starbucks, and this was reported by every station, said he was very demeaning to her.
Really?
Yes, but then in her interview, she said he was very loving and caring. So, I mean, there's so much stuff out there.
Is this just individuals who are looking, will we get the real, I mean, there's one side of the story, the other, and then what really happened?
The American public wants to know what really happened, and they'll be upset if they don't find out what really happened.
Well, Alex, I want to thank you for sitting in and being a part of this segment. I'm glad a member of the Peter Drossos, elect Peter Drossos state representative team sat in. And again, thank you for the pizza. Thank John.
My brother, I will thank him, and thank you for having us. I appreciate it, and I think my nephew's going to do a really good job.
The nephew's going to say something really quick because he's got 12 seconds.
Well, I just wanted to throw this out there real quick. Earlier, I mentioned that our social media wasn't up and running yet, but our guy, Jeff Morganelli, is doing a great job putting that together. And when it is up and running and ready to go, you should definitely look into hiring him out there.
Okay, all right. Peter and Alex Drossos, well, thank you guys for being on. We're going to step aside. When we come back, we're going to find out about Broketown, the novel put together by the one and only Dave Wheeler. Right here on Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny & Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. People ask me, is there anything they can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
Is there anything I can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
See? There is. Those big gravel trucks, when they're being loaded, rocks get stuck in the framework of the bed. Truck hits a bump, rock hits your windshield. It pays to stay way back.
It pays to stay way back.
However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
Be a part of the show. Call in and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Well, thank you for keeping your radio dial set here to Monday Night Talk. This is the final segment of our program. I got a fantastic guest, and as you folks know, I like having local folks in. Whether it's folks who are representing us, local leadership, folks who are getting involved, to authors. And my guest for this segment is a gentleman. He's been on the program before as a columnist. He's done a regular column for The Enterprise. I think it's in the Ledger, too.
Yep.
It's in the Ledger as well. It's Gatehouse Media. And it's almost kind of synonymous. We have Junior D'Amato in. Junior, our auto expert, Junior, does a regular column. So, you know what? And again, being a journalist, you know, I gravitate. And I've had conversations. Joining me right now, the voice you heard just a moment ago, is none other than Mr. David Wheeler. David, welcome back to Monday Night Talk, sir.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And, you know, as I premised our conversation, you being a columnist, it's been a while, and I think you're kind of, right now, you're just kind of on a little bit of a hiatus with it. What got you into writing? I know we know you as an educator, but what got you into writing? Why is that your passion?
So, great question. I've always loved writing, and one of the things that kind of made me mad as I got older was people kept saying, you can't make a living writing. You can't, don't do that. Have a backup plan. Do this, do that. And I did, and I had a backup plan, and I did all kinds of other things, and I still had that itch, that bug to write. And for a while, I was doing blogs when they came out, and I was a high school teacher for a while, so I was using the blog as a way to teach kids. But then you realize when you're in education, and even when you're a columnist for The Enterprise, there are some things you just can't say, yeah. Some things you just can't write about. And I felt very stifled. So I started this novel just kind of sitting at home and, you know, in my spare time. I like to get up early and write in the mornings. And it started kind of taking shape. And I showed it to a couple people, and they said, oh, you know, that's kind of an interesting little concept you have there. And then about a year into it, I said, I'm going to go full bore with this and really, really buckle down and get this done, because it was a lot more work than I thought it was going to be going into it.
And again, the book that he's talking about, we're actually, a part of our conversation is to talk about his new novel, Broke Town, which I have right here in my hand, a stark and captivating novel about life, loss, and the possibility of redemption in the unlikeliest places. I'm reading that off, of course, the back cover of the book. Yeah, myself, I consider myself a writer because I'm a reporter. I've also, myself, like you, been somebody who's worked for Gatehouse Media. I've always thought about writing a book, but I've interviewed my share of authors and heard the different stories as to how they got into it. I mean, we've had Hank Phillippe Ryan on here, somebody who was a, you know, an investigative journalist for Channel 7 that we see from time to time, but who is now, you know, part of her title now is that she's a best-selling author. Mm. We've had Casey Sherman, Marshfield guy, who's been in here, a guy, a former, you know, producer, you know, for in Boston for Channel, I think it was Channel 4, turned author. Somebody who is an author, now he owns a production company. Dave Wedge, another guy, another journalist.
Went to high school with him.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Okay, see,
yeah.
It's a small world. It's made of cotton. It's shrinking by the day here. Dave, another great guy, a Brockton guy, who, you know, went from writing for the Boston Herald as, you know, a breaking news political guy, who is now, he's a writer. And here, again, another guy. And I think I mentioned to you when I had said, hey, I got to have you come on in. You actually reached out to me probably a couple of months ago, but it was on my radar. Somebody reaches out to me, I try to make sure I get them on. But we had Maureen Boylan, another writer. So this is really cool that, again, you're in here, you get to kind of tell your story as to how you put this together. How did you come up with the outline? Was it something that you've kind of had floating around in the back of your head for a while, and it's been slowly developing, or has it been something that you've just been picking away at day by day?
So the quick summary of the book is it's about a teacher who is kind of trapped in a life that he's not happy with, and his wife ends up committing suicide, and he views this as a catalyst to be able to change his life. Mm. And that isn't what struck me. What struck me is one day I was driving through Brockton, and I saw this a mobile home just parked in an empty parking lot. And every night I would drive home, and I would see there was a light in it, and someone lived in it. And I started thinking about that, and I said, you know, I wonder what would happen if somebody just decided, I'm going to cash in everything in my life and just go on the road. But then the character, I realized that had been done over and over and over again, the road trip novel. So I decided to have this particular character pretty much break down in a place not unlike Brockton and decide I'm going to stay here and just hang around and wait until I figure things out for myself. And the main character gets immersed in the lives of, I would call, people on the fringes, people who don't necessarily work a traditional job, people who have, you know, whose hobbies are more about going to a bar room and hanging around with their friends than going to play golf, which is kind of the crowd that he used to be part of. And he found the hypocrisies in a lot of life, and he had, there was some darkness. There's some darkness in this book. And I think in my own case, I was in my mid-40s, and I was questioning a lot of that stuff, too. I'd been in education for about 20 years, and one of the things in education is, you know, you hang on until you get that 80% pension. And I started thinking about it, well, why? You know, why do you have to do that? There's so many different things that you can do in life. So I decided to do this. I decided to write this book. I ended up leaving my job in education and pursued a writing career full time. Certainly not selling books. I'm doing some writing on the side for other folks.
We'll talk a little bit about that afterwards.
Yeah.
Yep.
But the book just took shape. As I started writing it, I didn't use an outline. I had no outline. I once read something by Stephen King who said, you know, just let the story flow. Let it dictate to you where it goes. And sometimes that's hard to do. Sometimes you try to force it, and then, you know, we were talking earlier, you might write for a whole day, and then the next day take a look at it and go, oh, that didn't work.
Right.
And, you know, it's a wasted day. No, it's not a wasted day. It's a, well, that path didn't work. Let's try a different path. So that's what I did with this, and I just started incorporating some of the characters around Brockton. I'm sure there are some friends of mine that will see traits of themselves in here. And once they start bumping up against each other and talking to each other and conflicting with each other, that's where the novel really takes shape.
So my question, it sounds, correct me if I'm wrong, so are you saying Ted Wilson, who is the lead character in this book, so some of this can parallel David Wheeler's life and some of David Wheeler's associates? Just again, just common threads, not necessarily in its entirety.
Sure. I think that's true with it with any fiction writer. I think there's common threads that, you know, I would be sitting out to dinner and just overhear a snippet of a conversation and jot it down in a little notebook or jot it down on my iPhone and say, oh, I can fictionalize that and go in 100 different directions with that. So I think there's a lot of that. I think some of my attitude, some of my dissatisfaction with you know, working 9 to 5 every day for 30 years and then retiring. And is that really all there is to life or is there more to it? I think some of that comes out in this book. And I'll tell you, Kevin, my mom recently read the book and my brother called me up and said, Mom's been psychoanalyzing you for about a month now using your book, so you better be careful. And there's a line in there where a character meets somebody who sells ecstasy. So my mother called me up one day and she said, how do you know about ecstasy? And I said, how do you know about ecstasy, Mom? You're 71. So I had to explain to my mom that, you know, some of it is completely made up. But there, like you said, I like the term you use. There are threads throughout it that are part of yours and the people around you's lives.
Now, you just mentioned something in regards to you could be sitting somewhere and hear something and then be like, hey, jot that down. Are you also the type of guy that, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning, you wake up and all of a sudden, you get a little bit of an epiphany. Where you're like, going, hey, ooh. And then you instantly find yourself in front of your laptop or you're jotting something down so you can build upon that. Is that something that's part of it? That it could be, it's a 24/7 type of a thing that no matter when, no matter where you are or how it's happening, that you're going to take it as it comes to you.
It is a completely immersive experience, and you're absolutely right. You described it perfectly. The only thing you got wrong was the time. For me, it's 4 a.m. My eyes would open at 4 a.m, yeah. And some thought would pop into my head. And the bulk of this manuscript was written when I was single, so it was a little bit easier for me then to just, on a Saturday morning, you know, wake up and write all day if I had an hour and be able to go with it. Now I have a,
you know. Disturb the missus, right?
Yeah, right. But that's exactly what would happen. Rarely would I jot down an idea as that came from my own mind, only because I find when I jotted it down, I stopped thinking about it. So what I would do is keep it rolling around in my head for a day or two, and then sit down and write about it. And I found that to be much, much more effective.
Again, you're listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD, and our guest for the segment is Dave Wheeler, who's here to talk a little bit about his new book, his novel, Broketown, and kind of where we're picking his brain as to, you know, how did he come up with this idea? And again, Dave is not somebody who's just, you know, is an educator. He's somebody who also he does a little bit of writing on the side, something we'll talk a little bit towards the tail end of our conversation, because aside from the book, he finds himself where he's now, you know, getting involved and seeing what, you know, what other helping other people who are out there writing. We'll talk about that in a moment. So we meet this New Hampshire prep school English teacher, Ted Wilson, a guy, as you said, you drove by you every day and you see this mobile home. Well, it so happens that Ted decides to leave his job. He buys a vintage RV, heads out on the road. Where is he traveling all over the country, or does he find himself some kind of a secluded spot or some kind of an interesting spot?
His original intent is to drive around the country, and he quickly tires of that and decides that that isn't what he wants to do. And he ends up, like I said earlier, in a place not unlike Brockton. And there's a scene in there called the Wooded Lot, which is where he backs the RV into. And I can tell you right where that wooded lot is in real life. It's 166 East Ashland Street in Brockton.
Okay.
And I know that because I happen to be on the planning board in Brockton, and it's a little parcel of land that they've done nothing with. But I kept driving by that lot saying, you know, wouldn't that be great if someone just decided to live there and to see what happened? And a little at the time, Brockton was dealing with the tent city issues with the homelessness.
Yeah, up on the tracks.
Yeah, yep. And that ties into this. Ted comes across a whole settlement of folks who are camp out in a place not unlike, you know, a public park or something like that. And I started thinking about what happens when what we would call average regular people collide with these folks who decide that they're going to live in the woods, or they're going to, you know, have an encampment. And, you know, some of them are, you know, very sad figures, you know, you have drug addiction and alcoholism. But some people are just people who want to drop out of society and just want to do that. And I really was fascinated by those types of people. So this character, in turn, became fascinated with those types of people and, in fact, befriends some of them.
And I was going to ask you about that, because you actually kind of spell out, you know, a bunch of different individuals that he happens to come across. How do you kind of weave the individuals that he comes across? Because that has to be a reason why they cross his path.
Sure.
And kind of the purpose and what he's able to kind of take from the meeting, or at least kind of maintains or realizes that maybe he needs to move on from the relationship, or the, you know, beyond just saying, hi, nice to meet you.
So the vast majority of people, if you think about it this way, the vast majority of people work during the day. So they get up, they go to work, and their mind is otherwise occupied with work things. So I wanted to explore what happens when you don't work. What happens, who are the people you meet when you don't work and you stay within a given area? So let's say, you know, Brockton. You stay within a given area of Brockton. Brockton, who are the type of people that you meet then? And what happened here in this case was he found them to be not only interesting, but quite genuine. Genuine in their opinions and the mistakes that they'd made in life and how they got there. And like I said, he ends up befriending them. And I don't want to give away the ending of the book, because I think it's important for I think it's important for the reader to have something to look forward to. But I think Ted learns a lot about himself by kind of bumping up against these other characters that were not in his social strata for his entire life.
Mm. Well, and it sounds like to me it's part of a learning process for him. What's the key to you trying to build suspense and keep, you know, keep this a compelling story? You know, what was it like for you to be able to do that? Again, first book, and there's a lot of trial and error as to how to, you know, keep the story interesting, realistic.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then, of course, you have to, you know, with a book, you got to find, you know, you got to get them, capture their interest in the first chapter. This is what this is about. This is this interesting individual, and you're going to follow him along, and, you know, you got to kind of build the plot of the story itself.
Right. Another piece of great writing advice that, and I don't remember who said it, but or who wrote it, have your main character, introduce your main character, and then do everything you can to possibly make his life miserable. And in that will become interesting to the reader. And as the main character overcomes these obstacles, the reader starts rooting for him or her and wants to see this character become successful. So I always had that in my mind, like, yeah, wouldn't it be great if he could cash in his retirement for $1 million and buy a small home in the woods and just live there? Well, that's boring. That's not interesting.
It's boring, and it's probably 10 pages.
Right, exactly. So it's much more interesting when you throw a financial hardship in there, or you throw some suspicion that maybe his wife didn't kill herself, and maybe the police want to talk to him, and he's avoiding them for whatever reason. Things like that put a question in the reader's mind, like, okay, how is this going to turn out? And
right.
If the reader can't see clearly to the end of how it's going to turn out, you've done a good job.
And that's the key, is, I mean, life, you know, there's no, you and I have no idea what's going to happen, you know, beyond, you know, this moment.
Right.
You know, I mean, we could plan for things to happen, you know, over the next couple of days, but, you know, life is a series of twists and turns where, you know, we may be able to predict an outcome. Well, we may not be able to see a particular outcome. And you're correct. If you can captivate the reader with, like, oh, I didn't expect that.
Right. I think that's the key to the whole thing, is keeping everyone in a little bit of suspense. I don't mean like a page turner, you know, that's going to, you know, when I was a kid, I would read a Stephen King book, you know, with a flashlight under the covers waiting to see what happened. I don't think it's a book like that, but I think it's a book that makes you think, like, wow, what is this man's decision going to be by the end of this book? What is he going to decide? Because clearly he can't live in a camper for the rest of his life. So he's in this limbo right now. And how does he get from point A to point B? And what are all the interesting things that happen in between?
Would you want to see this go beyond just a book? Any thoughts, any conversations? Or are we too early in the process?
You know, no, we're not too early in the process. I have a good friend of mine who's a writer. His name is Chuck Burgess. And Chuck said to me when he first read it, he read an early draft. I have one or two or three friends that I have, you know, read first drafts and let me know what they think. And he said to me, this could be a screenplay. This would be a very interesting screenplay. And I've kept that in mind, and it's a goal of mine to probably at some point try and convert it to a screenplay. I know Amazon has an open call for screenplays right now. They, you know, they're producing so many of their own shows. So it's in the back of my mind to do, you know, maybe over the winter I'll tackle that. Right now I'm just kind of enjoying going around doing shows like this, talking to people about the book, and meeting other writers, I think, is a lot of fun too.
What's the feedback you've been receiving from folks who've picked it up, read it? You mentioned your mom, doing a little analysis of her son here.
Yeah.
How about folks who are, you know, maybe a layer or two outside of the family circle, friend circle?
So I was amazed the other day. I went on Amazon. The book is obviously available on Amazon. And I hadn't been paying attention. And I had 3 customer reviews on there.
Ooh.
Never didn't know who they were, had never heard of them. They were all very complimentary. They seemed to take a little bit of ownership in the book when they read it, and they had a little their own little twist on it. And I have to tell you, Kevin, that was one of the best feelings in the world for me, because it's all well and good to have your mom or your wife or your brother or your best friend read something that you've written, but it's a totally different feeling when it's a stranger who you're never going to ever meet, who decided I'm gonna take a shot on this book and actually take the time to review it, which I thought was excellent. You know, I can't tell you how many books I've purchased on Amazon that I haven't bothered to review. I can tell you I do it now. Ever since someone has done it for me, I realize how important it is. So the feedback has been pretty good. A lot of the, I would call my casual acquaintances that are, you know, traits of them are throughout the book. It has spread like wildfire through that little social group of mine. And I'll stop in at the local watering hole, and occasionally they'll say, well, who's this person? Is that me? I think this is me. Or one night I walked in, and one of the regulars came up to me, and he said, you killed me off early in the book. And it wasn't him, but he felt that it was him. So, you know, I didn't tell him one way or the other. I said, well, that's what you take from it.
So it's interesting that you've kind of built intrigue within your circle of folks who feel as though some of the common threads that you have in the book are them. And that's going to be intriguing to you, no?
I find people fascinating. And
I'm a people watcher myself.
Yeah. Oh, I just love it. I could do it all day long. And one of the things that I find most fascinating are people who either own their own businesses, have started their own businesses, are out there working, but doing it on their own terms. And this book is filled with people like that. Like I said, these aren't the folks that are the 9-to-5ers. These are the folks that, you know, there's one character, a musician in a wheelchair. And he drives around with him and his wife, and they have a van, and they just do shows. And it's based on a real musician. His name was Vic Chestnut. He sadly passed away in 2009.
Okay.
But I bring him kind of back to life in this book, and I imagine what the rest of his life would have been like had he stayed alive. Those are the people that I'm interested in. There's a character in here, Charlie Gass is his name, and he owns a chain of donut shops. And I started thinking about back when I was a kid, before there was a Dunkin' Donuts in every corner, you did have local and regional donut shop chains and coffee shops. Mm. And this owner is, I in the book, he's kind of the last holdout. Dunkin' Donuts keeps trying to purchase his chain, and he won't sell it. Those are the types of people that I find fascinating.
That's intriguing. A guy who grew up in Brockton. I actually lived down the street from Jimmy's Donuts, and that was a guy who had his own shop, and
right.
Sadly enough, I believe that he has passed away in that donut shop. I don't even.
It's gone,
and yeah. So it's that's funny that you mentioned that.
Yeah,
first
yeah.
thing that I think of.
Supreme. I think about Brockton still has a few Supreme donuts left.
You're absolutely. And, there's two of them.
Two of them. Yeah, and I think about that a lot too. Like someone's holding out. I don't know who owns it. Whoever you are, congratulations. They're holding out from the corporatization of America.
Amen.
And I think that's great. I'd like to see more people do that.
You got to keep corporate a little honest. Yeah. You know, there are other people who are willing to sustain on their own without having to be sucked in and subjected to corporate rules.
Yeah, here's your planogram. Here's, you know, here's what you're charging this for. Here's what you're charging for that. And
very interesting. So again, it's on Amazon. How much for the book? It's
$4.99 for the Kindle version, which I think is pretty good.
I was going to ask about Kindle.
Yeah, it's electronic ways. And it's $15 for the print version, which I think is a little expensive, but Kindle kind of helps you set those prices. Amazon rather helps you set those prices. So
and you're self-published.
I am self-published. I did the whole thing. The manuscript. I did the formatting. I had a little bit of help on the cover. An art student from Mass Art and Design helped me a little bit with, I had a vision of what I wanted it to look like, and he helped me.
Very intriguing. I like it.
Oh, thank you.
I do.
Thank you.
Any thought to if you are going to embark on a future, and I don't want to talk about any future projects. We're focusing on Broketown, a novel by David Wheeler here, our guest for the next couple of moments. Would you ever entertain being someone who's part of the whole publishing game and having a publisher want your rights to a book?
Yeah, I think that's the ultimate goal for me. I wanted to get this first novel that had been kicking around in my head for a while. I wanted to get it out. I wanted to get it done. I wanted to see if I could do it. I wanted to see if I could stick to it and get it done. Because, you know, I don't know about you, Kevin, but I probably know 20 people who have, you know, an unfinished novel somewhere in their desk or in their computer at home. And I wanted to be one of those, you know, 2% that actually finishes it before I decide, yeah, I'm going to jump in and do more in publishing.
And if I could, I'm just going to throw this out there. A dear friend of mine who actually passed away a year ago, somebody who was very well known when it came to a particular part of the whole JFK assassination. He was very enthralled with that. He was an expert that they would be called because he was an expert in the field of David Ferry, who was kind of a thumbnail on the whole story, but he knew it. And he actually had put together, I want to say probably 3/4 of a book. He had all of his stuff all put together, and we were looking forward to the day that I could do a radio interview with him. Sadly, he passed away, and I believe that his family is actually working to try to complete that. So kudos to you for being able to put 296 pages together and be able to share it out there and get out there and do your own marketing tell people what you're doing. Now, with the next couple of moments that we have here, you're now you get a chance to kind of do you're doing your own work, doing some editing as a business owner. You might as well call yourself that. Yeah. What's that like to be able to see other people's works and assist them to get it to where you got it to?
I wish I'd done it 5 or 10 years ago. Before that, the technology really wasn't there, but it's there now. Anyone can write a book. And indeed, a lot of people have. And I cannot tell you how many interesting people I have communicated with over this. I've never met them in person. Interestingly, a lot of my business comes from Texas and California. So I end up doing a lot of work for writers out there. It's fascinating. I just finished editing a book for a woman. It's called Have We Been Screwed is the title. And that's also available at Amazon.
Yes.
And she writes about she was raised in a religious cult. And so she writes about how she had trouble transitioning when she turned 18. She couldn't get away fast enough. But she had a really hard time adapting into what is quote-unquote normal society. Mm. But she's wonderful. She's an older lady. She retired early. She was a high school principal who retired early. And we've struck up a great friendship. And I've met so many people like that. I've met a lot of folks that are writing books for their family members, who they say, you know, I just want to put my story down so that, you know, someday when I'm gone, you know, generations will be able to know who I am and you know, what my contribution to this family was. And that's a really nice feeling to be able to help people do that. It's writing for the pure joy of writing sometimes. It's not, you know, I'm going to be the next Stephen King and write a bestseller. It's no, I'm going to put together a quality piece of writing that my circle, my social group can enjoy.
Folks want to find out more, do you have a website or do you have social media or something? We got just a couple of seconds.
I do, yeah. You can find me on Facebook, Dave Wheeler on Facebook. You can find me online at DaveWheelerOnline.com, DaveWheelerOnline.com. And then you can just search Broketown on Amazon and the book will come right up.
And leave a review. If you have a chance, buy the book, leave a review, whether you get the hard copy or you get the Kindle. Dave's a great guy. It's been a great conversation, Dave.
Thank you. Thanks
Thank
for
you
having
so
me.
Much for joining us here on this holiday, Indigenous People Day, Columbus Day, whatever you want to call it. Dave Wheeler has been my guest. So check out his new book, $15, right, on Amazon. And for $4.99, you can get the Kindle copy. And drop him a line and tell him whether you appreciate it or if you have any...
Cut it up. If you have feedback, send me feedback.
Mom's already doing it, so
yeah.
You might as well get in on the fun. That's all the time that we have here on the Monday Night Talk. But until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great evening.